This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
Broadcasting across the state of Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network and around the world on the Civic Media app, this is the Dom Salvia Show. And now, here's your host, Dom Salvia.
And welcome to the Dom Salvia Show. Happy 2025 to us all. We are revisiting some of our favorite conversations with some of our favorite guests. This hour, we're going to do a dive into our conversations with our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey Kay, Professor Emeritus of Democracy at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. First up, what is the Economic Bill of Rights from FDR? This new Economic Bill of Rights, and we've talked about it before, but now I'm even more enthused because there's like a comic book about it. Man, you got like a comic strip. Harvey, what's going on here, man?
I'll tell you what. I mean, besides the fact that when I was a kid growing up and along the way as an adult, I read comics, there was a comic book creator named Matt Strackbine, also known as, or his, you know, his name in the business is The Letter Hack. And he contacted me because he has a podcast show, and we had a conversation about my work. At the end of it, he said, wow, wouldn't it be fun if we could do a comic on this work you're doing on the Economic Bill of Rights, 21st century Economic Bill of Rights? And I thought about it, and we spent the next several weeks just, you know, musing about what it could be. And then all of a sudden, we both agreed, instead of worrying about a whole big 90-page comic book or whatever, we would do 10 to 12 pages to get the point across, get it out during this election season, and try to place it as we have placed it at Common Dreams, which is an online progressive website. I hope people go to look at it. And what was amazing is we knocked it off. I don't mean we knocked it off, but we got it done in probably like 2 to 3 weeks, and
wow,
he really worked on it.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing. He is, one, he's very talented. Two, he's the most patient person I can imagine working with, because here in the middle, like in the middle of a page of working on the different panels for the page, I would say, oh, wait a minute, we forgot something really important. We got to go back and start all over again, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he didn't get upset at all. So in fact, it's a shame I don't have him here with me, because he really is really fantastic. And the response to the comic book on the 21st century Economic Bill of Rights has really been enthusiastic. People keep saying, well, when are you going to bring it out in actual comic book form? Which I'm not sure if we're going to do that or not, but we are going to go ahead to do other similar kinds of things about American history, about American progressive life, American progressive story. And in fact, he and I are going to confer tomorrow morning about where we go from here. So thank you for noting.
It's great. CommonDreams.org. You can find it. We'll put it up on the socials so you can see it. A 21st century Bill of Rights. Let's dive into that a little bit. What is the content? What are you trying to get across to the readers? What's the message here, Harvey?
Okay, well, let me just give a brief historical note to that. And that is that in 1944, Franklin Roosevelt, in the State of the Union message, called for an economic bill of rights for all Americans. So in other words, standing on the shoulders of the Declaration of Independence and the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as the American promise, and the original 10 amendments known as the Bill of Rights, he said the time had come that Americans had come to realize that a needy person cannot be a free person. And thus he proposed an economic bill of rights for all Americans. Now, notably, he didn't do it just out of the, you know, off the top of his head. He had actually called for surveys in 1943, polls, interviews, asking Americans what they would like to see at the end of the war. And to give you an example, 85% of Americans, that was 95% of Democrats and 75% of Republicans, said they wanted guaranteed national health care.
Wow.
And that's just one example, along with education and decent housing. I mean, a whole host of things. So he thus proposed this Economic Bill of Rights. Now, it was the case, he knew it would not be enacted, because the power of the Republicans combined with the Southern Democrats, who at the time, of course, were
at the time, right?
At the time, the white supremacist Southern Democrats, that they would block such things. However, it caught the public's imagination. They had already indicated in their own, you know, responses to surveys the kinds of things they wanted. And the labor movement, both the unions in the AFL and the unions of the CIO, American Federation of Labor, and Congress of Industrial Organizations, which in those years were separate,
right,
the trades unions and the industrial unions, both federations took hold of it and turned them into national campaigns, along with the National Farmers Union and a new organization on a national scale of sort of working people and celebrities, the National Progressive Civic Action Committee, something like that. And in fact, the idea itself never actually died, so that after the war, Truman sought to create national health care, though he failed because of that conservative coalition I mentioned before. During the 1950s, for example, it was never lower than 50%, the percentage of Americans who wanted guaranteed health care. In the 1960s, the Democratic Party, in fact, the 1960 Democratic Party platform was modeled blatantly, stated right up front on FDR's Economic Bill of Rights. And then in 1965, A. Philip Randolph, the great black labor and civil rights leader, proposed a freedom budget, which was essentially inspired by the idea of an economic bill of rights. 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. called for an economic bill of rights. The idea never died. And of course, in 2016 and 2020, though he didn't make as much of it as he could have, he called, Bernie Sanders, that is, called for an economic bill of rights, as did Elizabeth Warren. So basically, it's what we're trying to do in this comic book, as I have tried to do in articles with Alan Minsky of Progressive Democrats of America, is remind Americans of something which is fundamentally American, and that is the aspiration to create an economic bill of rights, which would include the kinds of things FDR called for, but also guaranteed a right to a job, guaranteed a right to organize and be represented by a labor union in the workplace, and similar kinds of things. I mean, it's, and by the way, we actually had polling done by the organization Data for Progress, and about 70%+, depending on the particulars, wanted what went into what we call the 21st century economic bill of rights. The shame of it is that the Democrats have resisted picking it up and basically challenging America, not challenging, inviting Americans to embrace this as the alternative to the kind of evils proposed by the Project 2025 that the Republicans are trying to walk away from, but have clearly embraced.
Dr. Harvey Kay, the new economic bill of rights. Harvey, you talked about 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. He talked about it. And then what, Bernie, you know, that's a lot of time between 68 and 16 and 20. I was not into this, man. I mean, when I grew up, I don't remember hearing anything about this. I remember hearing about FDR and, you know, of course, the Great Society, these kinds of things. I never, ever heard about this new economic bill of rights that people wanted. And apparently a lot of people still do. Why did that come off the stage, in your opinion, Harvey?
Well, okay. So after World War II, business interests allied with conservative interests of the Republicans and the Southern Democrats, they joined in suppressing the memory of it, truly suppressing the memory of it. During the 1950s, it occasionally came up, but it was not the kind of thing that businessmen and women wanted to hear. They actually spent millions of dollars in the course of the 70s and since trying to suppress the Democratic aspirations that, by the way, let's not forget, we've had 50 years of this war on the democratic achievements of the generation of the 30s and the 60s. Let's not forget, what did they target? They targeted the rights of workers, the rights of women, and the rights of people of color, especially African Americans. So we've had these 50 years of this kind of suppression of the aspirations of Americans. And by the way, the Democrats, in the course of those 50 years, retreated from their own tradition. And it's only now, basically because of the efforts of Bernie and Elizabeth Warren back in, what is that, 10 years ago or so, that they began to put it back on the agenda. And we saw millions of young people turn out for their kinds of, for those, you know, those ideals. And now what we've seen, despite the fact it's not an economic bill of rights, we've seen the Democrats pay all the more attention to the surge of labor union activism.
Yes, yes. And that, I mean, so bits and pieces. And I get what you're saying. Obviously, these kinds of rights, quote unquote, I mean, there's money. It costs money to do these things. It costs money to provide health care for your citizenry. But it's not like that we're pulling new money. There's already money being spent. Is this would be reallocated? Do you think that there's an additional cost for a national health care plan? Do you think there's an additional cost, Harvey, for a guaranteed, quote unquote, guaranteed job? How do you practically see something like that working out?
Well, healthcare alone, it always astonishes me that people can't conceive of the possibility that if you basically, if you socialize healthcare, you're creating
socializing of the healthcare, because the federal government gets it. Government employees get it. The Army gets it. You know, if you're on Medicare, you get it. If you're on Medicaid, you get it. There's probably a third of the country in some way, some form, in my off, you know, the napkin calculation, Harvey, is getting some sort of quote unquote socialized healthcare.
Exactly. First of all, it's the moral thing to do, but it's also very much economically feasible. You know, Bernie was challenged back in 2020 on the debate stage. Was he trying to bankrupt America? And what he really should have done is both things. First of all, he should have made clear that that's exactly what they tried to do in 1935 when FDR and the Democrats enacted Social Security. It's going to bankrupt.
Right.
Number one.
Yes.
Okay. Number one. By the way, FDR, now I get to number two, FDR wanted national health care as part of Social Security in 1935. But the American Medical Association and corporate interests didn't want it. Now, why did they not want it? I mean, they didn't want it because as long as workers did not have the kinds of things they wanted, they were in some ways disabled or handicapped.
Yes.
Beholden. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And that's our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey Kaye. We're going to listen to more from Harvey Kaye in the next segment, talking about common sense. Does it even exist? And what is it?
You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome back to the Dom Salvia Show. Happy New Year. Revisiting some of our favorite conversations this hour. The best of Harvey Kaye, our favorite Delano Democrat, talking about common sense. Is it really that common, Harvey?
The shame is that the vast number of people just don't have enough historical memory, because I often say it, even though I favor public education over any form of education. It is the case that we are failing to teach the kind of historical memory that young people need to remind them of what it means to be an American.
Well, you're not going to want to start teaching all the kids this woke kind of talk, man. What are you talking about?
I'm not teaching woke anything. I want to teach them about the America's revolutionary promise: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yes.
I want them to learn about Thomas Paine, who basically when he issued the pamphlet Common Sense in January of 76, which led to turning a colonial rebellion into the American Revolution, not only for independence, but for the makings of a democratic republic. If that's the case, I want them to know about that. I want them to know why it is that they find America so exasperating these days.
You're the expert, man. What do you think Thomas Paine would be thinking today?
Okay, for a start, you know, I wrote a piece back in 2016. No, I wrote a piece after Trump won in 2016, in which I sort of was telling people that they really need to go and check out the pamphlet Common Sense, which was the pamphlet that Paine authored in order to inspire Americans to think not only of trying to win their rights as British subjects, but actually to separate, that is, create an independent United States and also create a democratic republic. And so I wrote this piece and I told people that when things happen, as Trump intends to, you know, to carry them out, grab hold of these lines and rally people. Make, you know, whether you have to do it in taverns or wherever you have to do it, rally people and ultimately let them call us rebels, as Paine said in some of his writings. So, you know, Paine came to this country in late 1774, and within 1 year, he had fallen in love with the country, not only for its resources and the people who were so rambunctious, but also because he couldn't believe how determined Americans were to govern themselves, even though they couldn't bring themselves to say, yes, independence. So really, the first thing he figured he had to do was disabuse them from any worshiping or idolatry or, if you like, sort of respect even for King George III. And there were great lines he offered. I don't want to bore people, especially
no. This is what we're talking about, brother.
Okay, but I do want to read this particular statement of his, Paine. This is where Paine is really going after the king. It says, "Men who look upon themselves born to reign and others to obey soon grow insolent, and when they succeed to the government are frequently the most ignorant and unfit of any people throughout the land."
God, that now, sounds so very familiar, Harvey. Why do you think that is?
Absolutely. So Matt Strackbine, the letter hack, and I, who've been doing a series of comic books on American politics and history, comic strips, we decided we were going to grab hold of Paine, invite him into the bar that we use as the starting point of our comics, and have him sort of teach us what do we need to know and understand about confronting, you know, Donald Trump.
Yes.
And the forces of MAGA and the Republicans. And so we laid hold of that quote. And if people get a chance to go to commondreams.org, I guess it is, and check out this Paine, No Pain, No Gain. Okay.
Yep.
I think you'll enjoy the cartooning if only because I appear and Matt appear in Continental Revolutionary garb. Okay. A three-cornered hat. But you'll see as well a B on the front of my tri-cornered hat. That's a B for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Okay. Just for the record. Well, having said that, So what Paine was telling Americans is how unique their opportunities were to make a country in which the common people would rule. No kings, no aristocrats, no overlords. And if he were alive today, he'd say no billionaires. But what have we got? We've got too many overlords, too many billionaires. And truly, if Donald Trump, the royal wannabe, is reelected, we're going to see all of that on steroids this time around. Not to mention, Paine said, look, this was a country that he encountered that, in contrast to what he knew of Britain and Europe, was diverse. He arrived in Philadelphia, and yet he had every religion imaginable was being practiced in Philadelphia, which was not the case back in England, or if they practiced it, they were being tolerated. Moreover, he said he loved the diversity of the ethnic ethnic and national diversity that prevailed. And he said, look, this is a land that could become an asylum for mankind. He himself was an immigrant and to some extent a refugee. He had been sacked by the British government from the Excise Commission. And he just found a whole new set of possibilities here. So in this comic, we say, Donald Trump, we don't use the term, is essentially un-American in the deepest original sense of what it means to be an American.
He certainly is. I mean, the comparison to King George and the characteristics that Payne applies to the king and the folks around him certainly apply to the MAGA and Donald Trump himself. And Asylum, man, don't get me started on the late great Dr. Hannibal Lecter. But Harvey, what's the hook? I mean, obviously there was a yearning for freedom. And even if you look at the messaging from the Harris campaign versus the Trump campaign, I mean, it is very, very freedom focused and very authoritarian. Daddy's going to spank you vigorously focused. You see what I'm saying? How did he, Payne, break through to the masses to help them find their way?
First of all, he spoke bluntly. He spoke in ordinary language. He was educated to a certain extent, but his father had been was a Quaker back in England, and his father didn't let him learn Latin or Greek. No offense, Jess. Okay, she did classical studies at college. Okay, but so he spoke a language because he was himself a working man, Payne. Okay, so part of the problem is that we have to be clear. I don't think the Democratic Party right now, for all of its down-to-earth vibes these days, I don't think it's doing that as effectively as it should. And I wish they'd call me up and I'd help them out.
Well, maybe we do have some common sense. Come back with us in our next segment, revisiting our conversations with Harvey K. Let's get physical. No, let's get radical with Harvey K.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
Welcome back to the Dom Salvia Show. Happy New Year to us all. We are celebrating by revisiting some of our favorite moments this hour. Harvey K. gets the nod. We're going to get radical. Your comments. I got a piece out when David Brooks goes Bernie bro. Now, this longtime conservative New York Times columnist is going Bernie bro. I mean, Harvey, what's going on in this world, man? Tell me what you mean.
Okay, well, let's start off with this, just if I can recount what I know of David Brooks. Let me start off by saying something on here. I don't think I've ever told publicly other than to people who know me well. And that is that I didn't mention this last week in any way, did I? That David Brooks and I were for a while friends.
No.
Yeah. Back in the late 90s, there was a fellow who was a senior editor, an editor at the Weekly Standard, which was Bill Kristol's magazine, neoconservative magazine. Basically, it was owned by Rupert Murdoch and run by Bill Kristol. But there was a guy there who called me to ask me about something regarding a group of intellectuals in Britain, the British Marxist historians. And I had basically written the book on them. And oddly enough, this guy and I got along pretty well, the one who called me, in spite of his being a conservative. And this went on for some time. I would ask his opinion and stuff, and we would exchange these kinds of
things. Yeah, that's what it's all about, man.
And he said, hey, when you come to Washington, which I did every so often because I have family down there, not to mention my representatives are down there, he said, let me buy you brunch. So we went to this really nice brunch place in Georgetown, and he said to me, next time you come, I want you to meet my friend David Brooks, who is another sort of editor and writer. I said, yeah, that'd be fun. Well, it wasn't as soon as I expected, but we went to lunch with David Brooks. And one of the first things I said to Brooks was, You know, I do follow the Weekly Standard. I think I was getting comped. The magazine was sending it to me free. Right. And I said, I have to say to you, the one thing I can't get over is you ask great questions when you write, but you always come up with the wrong answers. And he laughed and all that, but we kind of became friendly. And then before he left the Weekly Standard, he brought out a book, which became New York Times number one bestseller, Bobos in Paradise, which was his amazingly entertaining book about the sort of young urban professionals and the monies they spend to set out their, you know, to adorn their homes, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't matter to go into detail. So just before the book came out, I said to David, hey, why don't you come? This was in the spring of 2000. Why don't you come to Green Bay? You could speak at the university and, you know, we have a chance to talk and all that. And by the way, I had EJ Dion and David Brooks back to back, back to back. And they were buddies because they were both doing the National Public Radio commentary.
Okay.
So Brooks came, we had a really good time. But one of the things I said to him is, David, really, I love the questions you ask. And for example, back in the 90s, he asked about America's, the whole question of national greatness, because he was really worried that conservatives, Republican conservatives, and the ruling class of the day, he was very blunt in the language he used, was basically forgetting that America had a mission. And he was challenging them to behave like American elites are supposed to behave. People who believe in an American mission. It doesn't matter that David and I saw the mission as different, but the point was. And then I remember I wrote an article about that, and I said, in the end, I said, well, David, they answered your question, okay? This was eventually where this came up several years later. They eventually answered your question. Bush took us into Iraq. How's that for a mission?
Yeah, right.
It was that kind of thing. Then another thing that he asked, which, because he really always did ask good questions. Another one he asked is, what is America for? Which was kind of like, how come Americans have a need to understand what this country is about and they should be able to embrace it and be proud of it and advance it and all of that. And I thought, this is really good. But the problem is that he always, came up with a wrong answer. I mean, his answer had to do nothing with, you know, the fight for liberty, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or all men are created equal. That it was a totally conservative kind of answer.
Getting paid, yo. That's what America's for.
Yeah, I guess. And then he came up with a series of pieces, which we could summarize in terms of, before I forget, the other thing was, I'll read people what I actually said about Brooks on that, what is America for? How could David Brooks possibly appreciate and write informatively of America's purpose and promise? The promise inscribed in our historical memory and imagination by Thomas Paine's Common Sense, Jefferson's Declaration, the Founder's Preamble to the Constitution, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, FDR's Four Freedoms, and King's I Have a Dream. How could he appreciate the promise that inspired not just a Revolutionary War, but also generations of Americans to struggle to expand the we and we the people and the democratic process through which we the people can genuinely govern? And then he got into the set of pieces, which basically asked, because now he was really getting worried. He was worried about Trump because he's a neoconservative. He became a never Trumper? Is that what those guys became?
Yep.
So he asked this series of questions. The question in a series of pieces. What are we supposed to do about Trump? Because he diagnosed that the problem in America was the class divide, mm-hmm. which, by the way, and that to me, spoke directly to me and the stuff I'm interested in. But what he said is, we need to get out and meet each other. So he said, I'll commit myself to going out and discovering those other people, basically. And that one I answered in terms of, we don't need national therapy. We need we need radical action.
Okay. We might also need national therapy.
Folks, you're listening to the Dom Salvia Show. That's Harvey Kay, Professor Emeritus of Democracy at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay.
What do you mean radical?
Yeah. Talk to me about the radical.
So hold on. Well, here's the thing. So then the piece I wrote this past week was because within 24 hours after the election, the presidential election, he came out with a piece which basically said, voters to elites, do you see me now?
Yeah.
He was really emphasizing the problem of class division in this country. But he went a step further in that piece. To make the long story short, he said, maybe Bernie, you know, essentially, maybe Bernie Sanders was right. He said, maybe we should do the kinds of things Bernie called for, even if it would make people like me feel uncomfortable. That's me, meaning David Brooks himself. So I said, whoa, this is like, whoa, you know, it's like really major shift here. So I asked the question, you know, when does, you know, David Brooks go Bernie bro? When he goes Bernie, what's going on here, right? And it's basically the case that I said, he's not a Bernie bro, okay? But you know what? In the world in which we are right now, it would be damn good to have David Brooks talk to the middle of the road, Republicans and Democrats, about the need for really progressive action. There you go.
Harvey, I know you're the big FDR expert and fan here, and I saw your tweet from yesterday. I hope I never again hear a Dem say I'm a capitalist. Rather, I look forward to hearing them say I'm an FDR Democrat. And like FDR in 1930, quote, there is no question in my mind that it is time for the country to become fairly radical for at least one generation, unquote. Harvey, how does that quote from FDR apply to today, and what does it mean to you?
Okay, well, first thing to do, let's not forget that FDR is running for president around 1930. He is running for president in 1932, and that remark is from 1930. So that was really a to him, he looked around at America in the middle of the Great Depression, and he was fully aware of what was going on in Europe with the rise of fascism. And he was convinced that based on the fact that history in the United States was the revolution and the Civil War, if you're confronting a threat to the American promise, you have got to go radical. So in 1776, they declared independence, okay, and eventually set up the makings of a democratic republic. Lincoln, confronted by the secession of the South and basically what was going on in the military sector, you know, along the border between North and South, he basically said, we know what we have to do. This was a famous speech of his. Fellow Americans, we know what we have to do. The whole world knows what we must do. And basically what he does is he explains that that it was time to bring an end to slavery. And the Civil War in some ways was a second American Revolution in that respect. Well, FDR, thinking of the Depression and thinking of the threat of fascism, and there were fascist forces in the United States as well. In fact, the editors of Vanity Fair magazine actually said, maybe we could use a Mussolini to help lead us out of this depression. The president of the American Political Science Association said, who knows what America will become? Maybe it'll become fascist. Maybe it'll become communist. So the point is, FDR figured if you're going to save democracy, you've got to make dramatic changes. And when he ran for president, he laid out, contrary to what many historians have said, he actually laid out a fairly radical agenda. It was going to include such things as Social Security. It was going to include initiatives at major public works projects to put people to work and to modernize the American public, you know, what they call that, the superstructure of the United States, roads, bridges, tunnels. I mean, if you look across the United States, it's an amazing legacy that he left us.
Absolutely.
So his point is, you mobilize Americans, you put them to work, you engage them in the process of modernizing and transforming America, and you empower them, which is why he ends up signing into law first in 33, and then later, especially in 35, laws that would empower workers to organize. And they created the National Labor Relations Board to stand behind workers' efforts, not to mediate, but to stand behind workers' efforts. Then this is something people don't realize. In 1934, he actually did this a number of times through his 12 years as president. He decided that the inequality and the wealth accumulated at the top was a threat not only to the American economy, but also to the American democratic spirit, American democratic life. He called on Congress to cap wealth and incomes, at least at that time. And and the way he got
sounds like history's repeating itself.
Well, the problem, the problem is that the Democrats have not done that. We thought they might do it in 2020 because Bernie and Biden kind of got it together, and they set out an agenda together. But it is the case that Biden was stymied by people in his own party, And then he did do some change, make some changes, but not at all, not at all to the extent of a New Deal, but he had a hard time doing that. Yeah, so yeah. America, now, I don't think Americans voted to slash the budget by trillions of dollars. I don't think they voted to slash the taxes on the rich, which is, again, a likely possibility.
I mean, I hate to tell you, though, Harvey, I think Trump was talking about it, and maybe they did. Hey, let me squeeze in a caller here real quick before we run out of time. We got 2 minutes. Okay. Hey, Tom, you're on with Harvey. I know you got something about the Economic Bill of Rights. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Harvey, as you know, I am a proud FDR Democrat, and I want to know when it is that we're going to get a candidate that is actually going to speak not in terms of first off, everyone needs to learn who FDR is, and shame on us for not knowing who he was. But second, we just need to have a candidate come out and say, I am going to fulfill the second Economic Bill of Rights of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That's what we need.
Thank you, Tom. Harvey, do you have a candidate in mind, and do you think that's coming anytime soon?
Well, Bernie did do that, okay? And the shame is that Bernie didn't do what I said we needed a candidate to do, say, I am an FDR Democrat. He made it a point of saying, I'm a Democratic Socialist. Most Americans' heads turned if they even understood the term. So I think it's a possibility. I think there are folks on the horizon. There are political figures who I've spoken to. The problem is they have yet to fully come out in favor of an economic bill of rights. So hard for me to say, but I ain't stopping. I'm going to keep pushing.
Socialism, is it really that radical? Next up, Act 10 ruled unconstitutional. We're going to dive into that with Harvey Kay. I should have said something.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back to the Dom Salvia Show. Act 10 ruled unconstitutional. Our favorite socialist, Harvey Kay. He's a Delano Democrat and a friend of the show. We're going to dive into Act 10. You had some thoughts. You had some memories you want to share. Please do, Harvey.
Yeah, I mean, when I got a text from my friend John Shelton, who's the vice president of the AFT in the state, telling me of the judge's decision, I mean, I was close, not to crying, but I welled up a little bit because I remembered so well the night that my wife and I went down and spent at the state capitol marching around and then going into the capitol. First of all, I think it's important for everyone to know that this was the state that in 1959 first granted public employees the right to organize and bargain collectively. We were the history-making state, and it was astonishing to my mind that here was 50 years later, 51 years later, 52 years later if you count to 2011, in which Republicans were stripping working people of their rights in this state. And that was truly, in the grand course of history, that was a criminal act, really, okay? And they shoved it through in a late night thing. They knew that if there was a public debate about all this, they would definitely not have their way. But they got their way. Now, when we went down, and the marches had already begun over several weekends, my numbers may be off, but I went down with the spirit of, look, I'm a union member. I've got to be down there at least for some time to express my anger, and yet at the same time, my hopes that we could save our collective bargaining rights. Well, first of all, I was amazed. I mean, it was cold down there in Madison. It was cold all across the state. It was cold. And people were marching around very peacefully. And also what amazed me is the degree to which you felt a certain sympathy on the part of the police who were supervising it all of that. And then when you got into the Capitol, if you opted to go in, I mean, it was not just masses of people, but I could not believe how clean everything was. I mean, it was in many ways sort of so Wisconsin. It was clean. It was orderly. Everybody was nice. Everyone was having a good spirited time. Okay. This is what democracy looks like. And at a certain point, I did tear up on occasion that night. I could not believe just how much the feeling of solidarity prevailed. And I was a columnist at the time with an occasional columnist for the Huffington Post. And I wrote a piece about it. And I said to people, this was a night in which one had to feel proud to be a Wisconsinite, not because of the state legislature, God forbid, okay, but because of the state's citizens and how we turned out. And by the way, that place remained clean, completely in contrast, should any MAGA type bring it up, to what transpired that day on January 6th, in which people stormed the Capitol and were prepared to kill and maim and kill people. I mean, this was a totally different experience. So, I was Wisconsin proud then, and now I'm hoping I can be truly again Wisconsin proud. And don't forget, later the Republicans turned around and turned us into a right-to-work state, even for private sector employees. So we have a lot to take back. You know, I used to say take back America. Well, I say take back Wisconsin.
Harvey Kay, Professor Emeritus of Democracy, University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. A little bit from the reporting, as mentioned, the lawsuit here claimed that the law violated equal protection guarantees. The judge, Frost, agreed. And here's what he said. I cannot solve Act 10's constitutional problems by striking the definition of, quote, public safety employee, leaving the term undefined and leaving the remainder of the law in place. He added that Act 10, as written by the legislature, specifically and narrowly defines public safety employee. It is that definition which is unconstitutional. The legislature cites no precedent for this bold argument that should simply strike the unlawful definition and leave it to an agency and the courts to later define as they see fit. I am unaware of any such precedent. Interpreting public safety employee after striking the legislative definition would be an exercise in the absurd. Of course, Scott Walker had something to say about it, Harvey. He called it brazen political activism. Quote, this makes the April 2025 Wisconsin Supreme Court race that much more important. We want a state where legislators and the governor make the laws, not the courts, question mark.
Also, hey, wait, is that the Scott Walker who conned us with Foxconn? Wait a minute. Is that Scott Walker?
I think it's that same
guy.
One. Yeah,
that guy.
That one.
He goes on in a second tweet. Collective bargaining is not a right. It's an expensive entitlement.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. It's outrageous. No, right. He took the – by the way, it wasn't like it was just they took away our collective bargaining rights. I mean, that was criminal enough. They actually took away parts of our income, okay? I mean, I lost 10% of my income every year because he decided that my pension shouldn't be as good as it was and that he was going to take the money and make a gift – in his mind, to the citizens of Wisconsin, and never mentioned, by the way, I'm giving you some money because I've just taken it out of the pockets of teachers and professors and basically the folks who serve you in the public realm.
But not the cops, which, of course, comes to the equal protection.
Well, not some of the cops.
Some of the cops, they did. The West Dems, Harvey, for our last statement here, Ben Wickler issued a statement today. Today's ruling marks an important victory for working people in Wisconsin and affirms what's long been clear. Scott Walker's attack on public employees was not just a national disgrace. It was unconstitutional. With this decision, working families will once again have the right to organize, a right stripped away by Scott Walker's divide-and-conquer strategy that pitted working Wisconsinites against each other to the benefit of wealthy special interests. And Harvey...
That's well said. The best thing I've ever heard him say. Well said.
And you think the unions are acting right now? They're getting on the horse and they're getting ready to organize?
I know my union is. I know my union was active, I believe, in that particular lawsuit that the judge decided on.
Thank you all for listening to the Dom Salvia Show. The best of. Appreciate Harvey Kay and Egan Wachau and Susan Webb Yagi for joining us. Also, Jody Habish Sinekin. Come back with us live tomorrow. Have a great night. We'll see you then.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.